If Turing wanted to send an electric current through, but only when a particular decision was made, he would just have to lead that current up to one of these special ore veins. At first, the current would wait there, dripping electrons uselessly, unable to cross. But let that ore vein be transformed by the subtle techniques Bratton and Bardeen had developed, and then everything changes. The ore vein tunnel changes, and the signal can now roar along. A new technology was born, which meant that someone had to come up with a new name. "We have called it the transistor," Bell's research director explained at the press conference launching it on Wednesday, June 30, 1948. It is composed entirely of cold, solid substances. The first applications came easily. The Bell companies had long had a tradition of making devices to help the deaf, a legacy from Alex's love for Mabel, and it was natural to use transistors to make them smaller. This was helped by the fact that John Bardeen himself was married to a woman who is hard of hearing. Hearing aids are a bit like phones that have to be carried around. But ordinary telephones were clunky machines dating from the Victorian era with big wires and switches. They needed many trillions of bouncing electrons to transmit even a dim whisper. With transistors inside, however, it was possible to rely on far smaller batteries, for fewer electrons needed to be shunted around. Computer designers learned what was going on, including Turing in England, as with his 1948 letter from Jack Good. In America, Grace Murray Hopper, working at Harvard, took such confidence from knowing that improved microscopic switches were coming up that it seems to have helped her in developing the world's first compiler, an indispensable part of modern computers, which translates the programmer's instructions into the arcane listing of switch positions inside the computer. She had followed women's basketball for years and often noted how a forward pass took place. The person throwing the ball imagined the spot where she expected a teammate to catch it and began the throw even before her target was there. Hopper liked explaining in later years how she used that image in the logic of her earliest compilers to send out instructions that would be waiting in advance of the actual switch shifting the computer was undertaking. But when Hopper did her pathbreaking work on compilers in 1952, 4 years after the Bell press conference, she still had no workable transistors to use. The team that had been so successful in 1947 had broken up. Partly it was because Bell executives wanted solid, reliable components for their continent-wide phone switching system. Their goal was to have parts that would fail only once every 20 years, yet the first transistors failed almost every day. An entire batch was once ruined when technicians touched it after opening a door. Their hands transferred enough copper atoms from the doorknob to destroy the silicon's ideal mix of extra atoms, which could slow or energize electrons as needed. Bardeen and Bratton were discouraged by the lack of support. They also suffered from being under the ostensible supervision of William Shockley at Bell, and Shockley was a man with very strange views. When he'd first met Bardeen's wife, Jane, he told her that his own children were inferior to him. Jane had demurred, thinking that her hearing aid had failed. But no, Shockley explained, it was a fact, and the reason was that his own wife was genetically inferior to him as well. When Bardeen and Bratton built their working transistor, Shockley was beside himself. How could these two men have gotten there first? Shockley tried to take credit for the work. Although he improved their initial ideas considerably, that wasn't enough. He wanted everyone to believe that he had, basically, done it all. Bardeen left, and then others. And with no one remaining to yell at, soon Shockley left as well. Although this meant no transistors were mass-produced in time to save Turing's life, it did have a remarkable benefit. For Shockley was such a good liar that when he left Bell Labs to create his own fortune in the apricot groves and scattered factories of a valley south of San Francisco, many of America's most skillful engineers and physicists wanted to work with him. He was, after all, the man on the cover of Electronics magazine, peering into a microscope at his desk at Bell Labs. He had been feted at the press conference announcing the transistor. There were rumors that a Nobel Prize might soon be his. They came, they saw Shockley in action, and they fled. But while the engineers he'd forced out of Bell Labs dispersed across the entire country, those he forced from his new company, modestly named after himself, liked the California sun so much that they didn't go far. he managed to lose not just Robert Noyce, who co-created the modern technique for printing vast numbers of transistors on individual chips, but also Gordon Moore, who co-founded Intel, the most successful of all companies for fabricating those chips. Noyce became a millionaire, Moore probably a billionaire, while Shockley, never making any money, unable to get the ingrates who flocked to him to recognize his genius, kept on repelling more ambitious bright engineers who joined forces with his competitors. The apricot groves had a new name. Silicon Valley was born. And the world changed again.